Okay. Hello and good morning. So, how's everything? So, what's new? What's interesting? What in cosmology fascinates you, if anything? Okay. What is that?
Like filament formation. Like
you like filament formation.
I mean, I don't know anything about it, but if anybody knows anything about it, that'd be really, really cool to hear.
Yeah, now that's a cool topic. We should discuss that at some point. But we'll start with homogeneous universe as the first step. Then we can start think about filaments and pancakes and monopoles and things of that sort. But so let's start by questions about yesterday's lecture or the tutorial. So I understand that you rederived Friedmann equations based on what I found here. What happened to the yesterday time? Okay. So you rederived Friedmann's equations based from Einstein's equation, right? Everything went smoothly. How about the empty universe? Did you get to think about that or not?
Yes.
You did. Okay, perfect. So now you have two ways of deriving Friedmann equations from Newtonian physics and from Einstein's gravity. And interestingly, both of them give you the same answer, which is good. And now the exercise about the empty universe. The point of that is actually to tell you what we may call Doppler shift, or Doppler redshift, or blue shift, and gravitational or cosmological redshift, or blue shift. They are not really that different. They are basically different sides of the same coin, at least in some situations. And the most obvious situation is an empty universe, that if you have a universe whose matter density actually very small. So by now you know the Friedmann equations. So you know these equations. So this is one of them. The matter density goes to zero. You have an empty universe. And of course, Minkowski's space is an empty universe, because the only thing that carries space-time is matter. At least, if there is no matter in the space-time, doesn't mean that it's necessarily not carried. You could have gravitational waves. But if you do have matter in the space-time, it is definitely carried, because Einstein equation tells you that if you have matter, that's the right-hand side of Einstein equation, there should be curvature, which is on the left-hand side of Einstein equation. However, if matter density goes to zero, then you can, in principle, have a flat Minkowski space time with no curvature. However, this equation, the Friedmann equation, tells you that, so you would naively think that means A is a constant, because A was the expansion factor. So if you remember the Friedmann metric, the FRW metric, it looks like this. So you would naively think that if you want to have a flat background, if you want to have Minkowski space-time, you need A to be 1 and K to be 0.
Excuse me, the
R squared. Oh, sorry, yeah. This is the R squared. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Yeah. If A is 1 and K is 0, that's going to be a flat universe. But actually, what this equation tells you that's actually a solution, but that's not the only solution. So actually, if A is 1 and K is 0, this is 0, this is 0, that's consistent. But more generally, the solution that you get is So they, since this is on the right hand side is 0, you get a dot squared plus k equals 0. So this tells you that k must be negative because a dot squared is positive. And we decided that we can normalize k. It could be plus 1, minus 1, or 0, depending on sign. So if it's minus 1, it's negative, that tells you that a dot is 1, a equals p. This is a universe, this tells you that a equals p. So the empty universe generally has its expansion factor grows as p. But then what you showed is that this is actually just a piece of, this space-time is just a piece of Minkowski space. If you take a Minkowski space and imagine that you have four moving observers, that are moving away from each other, and they fill the whole light cone, so these are all observers that are moving away from each other with different velocities, then you can actually use a foliation of this space on the coordinate system, an alternative coordinate system, which really looks like this, constant time surfaces here. And in that coordinate system, if time is the proper time of these observers, co-moving observers, and a space is, well, it could be anything, anything that's constant for these co-moving observers, then you actually end up with this space time, as opposed to the Minkowski space time. So these two are equivalent. Now then the interpretation of cosmological relativity in this space time is just the ordinary special relativistic Doppler shift, basically. Because if each of these have all velocities, that then since the guy is sitting at rest here, this guy is moving away from him, that means that if this guy sends a signal, this guy is going to see it with some redshift. So anyway, so that's why cosmological redshift and Doppler redshift are not that different. Now, if this is not an empty universe, then you cannot do this because the space-time is genuinely curved. But there is still this similarity, at least on the small distances. You can always think of this gravitational redshift, 1 plus d equal to a naught over a, as Doppler shift. And the Hubble law, which you derived 2 days ago, basically V equals hr, this velocity is actually, you could interpret it as whatever that leads to this redshift. So this is the same as a redshift and a small distance. So I'm actually going to derive this for you, I think, today. But before I do that, so any other question from yesterday? So one thing that I think I got a bit confused somewhere through the talk was the tree sphere and what different coordinates are. So let me just go over them quickly. So I introduced two coordinates. One was r, which is what's more commonly used, is this one. And if k is plus 1, that, as I said, this part is just a tree sphere. And I'm just repeating what I said yesterday. So it's as if you're sitting on a tree sphere. And so this r is really representing a square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared. And w is some fourth imaginary coordinate. It's not a real coordinate system. And you're living up here. R equal to 0 refers to both here and here. So this coordinate system, r going from 0 to 1, actually covers half of the sphere. So that's what we actually concluded at the end. R going from 0, which is up here, to 1, covers this half of the sphere. And if you want to cover the other half, then R basically reaches a maximum here, and then it starts decreasing again. And if you want a coordinate system that basically covers the whole sphere, you should go to the chi, which was this integral of dr, dy by a square root of 1 minus r squared. And this was basically like the angle measured from the North Pole. So this one actually does cover, you can define it in a way that goes from 0 to pi over 2 here, and from here to here it increases from pi over 2 to pi. So that's the difference between these two coordinates. R is actually doesn't uniquely cover this surface. For every R, there are 2 points. But chi is like an angle which basically uniquely covers. For every chi, there is 1 point. But origin could be anywhere. The same way, you mean is this origin? Or this origin?
Like from where you measure angle.
This chi is measured from up here. So this is chi, let's say. So if you're at this point, chi is the angle from this, from the North Pole, for example. Because North Pole could be any point. Right?
The angle is the plane of the equator,
so well, pi. Pi over 2 minus that, or 90 degrees minus that. So this is this angle from the North Pole.
Okay.
So it's like, yeah. So that's pi over 2 minus the latitude. But this is like this, the angle in spherical coordinates that you use. So anyway, so this is the story of the 3S sphere. And so today I'm going to tell you a little bit about how this, you can actually work with this metric in the real world. And for that, of course, we need to know what A of t is. And that depends on the Friedmann equation, which now we have learned and derived from more than one way, and the matter content of the universe. What sits here instead of rho? So, good. So we have no questions till now. We have everything under control. No? Yes? Okay. So this was one equation. So we want to keep this Friedmann equation. It's essentially the most important equation in cosmology. And, okay. So one thing that I left off that probably, I think maybe I want to finish it, is the definition of distances. So let's derive the distances. That's also an important part of kinematics. Cosmological kinematics. And then I'm going to solve Friedmann equation for you. So there are two types of distances. Let's first look at angular diameter distance. And the main point is of defining this distance is that in a Euclidean space or in a Minkowski space, you have a clear notion of what you mean by distances or angles or different geometrical objects. But in a non-Euclidean space-time or in a non-flat space-time, then really the only thing that really you understand very well or have unique definitions are observables. And you have different ways of defining observables. You can define observables based on how bright things are. For example, if there is a star and you can measure its brightness, that's one observable. You can measure things based on their angular size. If you have some object, say a ruler, and you see it from a distance, and you can measure its angle, that's another observable. You can actually use either of the two for measuring distances. So they are both, so either angular diameter distance or luminosity distance. So these are different definitions of distance that in a flat spacetime they are the same thing, but in a curved spacetime they aren't necessarily the same. And these are actually very important observationally, because these are actual ways of measuring distances. So for angular diameter distance, there are so-called, I'm not sure, can you see if I write here? No, okay. So there are standard rulers. Let's try to move this a little. Well, maybe not. Maybe I'm going to try to write on the other side. So there are so-called standard rulers. So let's say that you have a satellite that you build on Earth, and you send it to space. Now, if one way of measuring the distance to the satellite is to measure how big it looks in the sky with a telescope, and if you know the angular distance, if you can measure the angular size of the object, so delta theta, this should be the size divided by the distance, in, if you are roughly speaking. Right? If angle is small. So, and you know the size of the satellite because you built it and sent it to the space. And you can measure the angular size with your telescope, in principle. So this is one way of measuring the distance. And but this requires having a standard ruler, so-called a standard ruler, something that you know how big it must be in principle. Now, for the case of satellites, since you built it, you know how big it is, assuming that its size doesn't change. Now, in cosmology, it's a bit more complicated because, of course, we cannot build things and send them to cosmological distances. That takes forever. But there are, based on the physics of the early universe, our understanding of physics of cosmology, there are certain sizes that you believe are fixed by the early universe physics. And you're going to hear about, more about them during next week. But essentially, acoustic oscillations in the early universe, sound waves in the early universe, imprint a certain scale on larger scale structure of the universe. And that you usually think of that as a standard ruler, something that's fixed by the physics of the early universe. And if you can somehow measure the angular size of that scale at different distances, then you can actually measure the distance. So I think Hirania next week is going to discuss more about that. But I guess I'm not going to tell much more about it. These are, just in order for you to have heard something about this, these are called so-called baryonic acoustic oscillations. So these are the sound waves in the early universe, essentially. So at early universe, temperature was high, so sound waves were, the sound speed was high, and acoustic oscillation or sound waves would travel large distances. And that actually imprints a scale on, basically a larger scale structure everywhere. You can think of it as a standard size. Now, the other way that you can measure distances is through luminosities. If you have something, a standard candle, as it's known. So let's write this here. You have a standard candle. I wonder if you have different color charts. And it's a bit too late, but anyway. So it looks a bit dull, everything, like white on the white background. But anyway. So if you have something that you know is luminosity, and again, do the same thing. So again, there's an example of the satellite. If you have something that emits a signal of a certain luminosity, a certain brightness, that's a standard. And you just send it away. Depending on how bright it looks, you can measure its distance. And that's through a relationship that the observed flux, basically energy that you receive per unit area, per unit solid angle, that's going to be the intrinsic luminosity divided by 4 pi distance squared. Right? This is called the luminosity distance. This distance, d sub a, is the angular diameter distance. And in the Euclidean space, these two are the same. In a curved space-time, they don't need to be the same. And it's actually easy to derive what they are in a space-time like this, because this is such a simple metric. Okay? Yes?
So here we basically guess the luminosity based on the kind of star or whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly. So yeah, I guess it's a good thing you brought it up. So I guess I'm not going to get much more time to talk about it. So for a standard ruler, these are the baryonic acoustic oscillation, basically sound horizons, or how far sound waves can go in the early universe. In this case, you have certain types of the stars. So more historically, there have been so-called Cepheids, which are variable stars with whose was somebody around the turn of the last century in 1900 discovered that the brighter they are, the longer is their variability period. So if you measure their variability period, you can say how intrinsically bright they are. And then that's the way to essentially standardize the candle. If you measure how long it takes for that to vary, you can guess what is their intrinsic luminosity. And of course, you can measure their flux, and that gives you the luminosity distance. Now, it turns out that you cannot see separated stars at very far away, so this is not very helpful for very large distances. Most recently, and there are a large number of other standard candles, or some combinations of standard rulers and standard candles, but most this is the first one historically. And right now, the most cosmologically relevant one is so-called supernovae 1A. And these are basically stars, white dwarfs, that for some reason at some point decide to go supernova. And we don't exactly understand what are the processes that are related. But one thing that people have discovered is that if you look at different supernova 1A, that from other methods, you know, they are at the same distance, they are happening in the same galaxy or in the same cluster, for example, their luminosity is essentially more or less the same. There is some calibration similar to Cepheids, that some of them are bright a bit longer, some of them are bright a bit shorter. So you have to do some calibration for how long they take. But after that calibration, they are actually very standard. The nice thing about supernova is that they are very bright. They are very bright for a short period of time. So you have to catch them right when they go off, which is, I think, a few days to a few months. But since they are very bright, you can see them at very large distances in principle. If you think you know their intrinsic luminosity from some calibration or some other astrophysical method, then you can measure their flux, then you get a distance. Yes.
What do baryonic acoustic oscillations look like? How do you use that as a standard rule?
So, it's a very good question, and these are probably have things, something to do with things that I never get time to talk about, but maybe I will. So the way it works for baryonic acoustic oscillation is that if you look at galaxies in the sky and look at the two-point correlation function. So do you know what the two-point correlation function is? Essentially, it's average of density at one point and density of galaxies at another point, r plus delta r. Right? That's essentially. And if you measure this, so this is called psi, up to some normalization. But let's say you measure psi as a function of delta r, what you see is that this is roughly a power law, well, something that has a smooth behavior, but it has a bump in it. And this bump is actually the size, how far the sound waves had traveled during the early universe. This is about 100 megaparsec, it turns out. Which, this is, I think this is one of the problems that you're gonna solve, I think, in a couple of days. But it's just, this is how it's measured. That if you look at the two-point correlation function of galaxies in this sky, and of course it depends on how far the galaxies are, because this is fixed in co-moving coordinates, as it turns out, this 100 megaparsec. So if you look at something as closer, it looks bigger in the sky, the angular size. If you look at something as farther, it looks smaller in the sky. But if you know how far they are, then you can actually measure this two-point correlation function, see where this bump is. And that should be about 100 megaparsec. That gives you the distance. Yes?
Yeah. In this, you have subtracted the dipole moment with the Earth, like in
This has nothing to do with the dipole moment of the Earth, because these are just galaxies. So the dipole moment of the Earth has to do with with CMB, basically, mark on my background. And
but then you're not subtracting. Okay, so you don't care about.
Yeah, for this, I don't care about dipole moment. So that dipole moment of the Earth, that has to do if you're moving in one direction, then you see a dipole. But actually, this is a much bigger effect than that dipole, and on very different scale. So that's not a big concern here, actually. So this is how people measure it. So it's a statistical measurement. It's not, you don't really have an actual ruler, which, I mean, of course, one shouldn't be surprised. There is no actual ruler in the universe. But we think we understand something about the statistics of the universe, in particular that there is this particular scale associated with physics in the early universe. It's built into it. So, okay. Now, since I don't want to spend too much time, so I told you what these are. I'm actually going to skip the derivation, but derivation is actually very straightforward. All you have to do for angle, basically, you just take this Friedmann metric and either calculate proper length in it. If you, for the angular diameter distance, what you do is you take a sphere, put a ruler at some distance. You know its proper length based on the spatial part of the metric. And you can measure its angle, is just its angular extent in this metric, in this coordinate. And that's all you need. So it's just very straightforward. So that gives you the expression for dA, which is just A times R. So let's write it here, dA. Just A times R, and R is the same R as that. And usually, if you remember, we had also this relationship, 1 plus Z is A naught over A. And A naught, people usually set it to be 1, so it's just 1 over A. One thing I should remember that this people do both of these very often. They often say A naught to 1. But they also said normalize k to plus 1, minus 1, or 0. You cannot both of them. You cannot do both of them at the same time. So you can either normalize a naught or you can normalize k, because, of course, if I remember from yesterday, that the normalization of the two are related. You cannot normalize both of them at the same time. But it's okay. So I think if it was up to me, I wouldn't normalize k. I would just normalize a naught to be 1. So a naught is the scale factor today, essentially. So that if you do that, then what you get is this is R divided by 1 plus Z. Now, for the luminosity distance, I mean, this is not very surprising. This is AR because your distance is essentially A times R. This is the angular part of the distance. If you have a ruler that doesn't extend in radius, it just extends in angle in d omega, then your distance is just A times R here. This is very straightforward. The luminosity distance is a bit more involved to derive, but it's actually R times 1 plus Z. And the reason that is like that is you have to take into account the cosmological redshift. The photons that are emitted, say, if let's say this is your source, and it emits photons, and then somebody here is observing the photons. So we are sitting here and observing the photons. The fact is that these photons are redshifted because of this cosmological redshift. So the luminosity goes down because of the redshift. That's one effect. The other effect is that the rate of receiving the photons is also slower, because essentially a redshift is the same as the slowing down the rate, right? The time period gets longer, or the rate gets slower. So you have two effects. First is the energy of photons go down because of the cosmological redshift. And second is that the rate of receiving photons goes down. So you have really two factors of 1 plus Z. And there's a square coming in from somewhere. And this is what, well, actually, no. So you have two factors of 1 plus Z. But this flux goes as 1 over dl squared. So it's as if dl is a scale, becomes longer by a factor of 1 plus z. So you have these two different distances. And notice that they are not the same anymore. And a small redshifts, which are small distances, they are the same. But at large distances, they are different. The angular diameter distance is smaller, is shorter than the luminosity distance. It's actually interesting because angular diameter distance, as you go to very high redshift, it decreases. So where should I plot this? Let's plot this here. So if you plot two distances as a function of redshift, now I have to tell you how R and redshift are related, and that actually depends on the solution to the solving this guy, basically. And we're gonna see that in a moment. But it turns out that if you plot these two distances, angular diameter distance goes up and then comes down, but the luminosity distance just keeps growing up. So actually, the one thing that it tells you is that objects that are very far away are even dimmer than what you expect from Euclidean physics, because the luminosity distance is larger by this extra factor. But then rulers, you can see them at very far. In principle, there is nothing that keeps you from seeing them. Well, if they are very dim, then you cannot see them. But it turns out it's funny that as you go to very large distances, angular diameter distance actually goes down. So you can actually use, it turns out that you can use this to farther distances in practice. So you can use the standard rulers to farther distances and the standard candles. Okay, good. So these are standard candles and the standard rulers. One calculation that I have to do for you is to derive the Hubble law, which I guess, yes.
So if the d8 goes to zero, mm-hmm. but the size of the object doesn't actually go to zero, then does that mean like the angle it takes up goes very large?
Yes. Let's see. Now, is there a way? So this is the definition of. So if d8 goes to zero, that means that if you want to have the same delta theta, no, am I saying this right? Then size should go to zero? No, is that, no, but you were saying the other way around, right? So if you fix the size, that means the delta theta goes to infinity. Now, what happens is basically at very early times, A becomes very small, right? So co-moving objects, everything becomes very small, essentially. So if you want to have something that has a fixed size, it should have a huge co-moving size, basically, right? If you want to have something have a fixed physical size, it needs to have huge co-moving size. So that basically fills the whole sky. That's exactly true. So if you want to fix physical size, so this is the physical size, but then take something to very early times, then it's going to fill the whole sky. Of course, we don't have anything with fixed physical size, it turns out. So even this, I guess I did a bit of cheating in this definition, but it doesn't really matter much. This baryonic acoustic oscillation has a fixed co-moving size, like a fixed physical size. So it doesn't have this 1 plus d, actually, for the baryonic acoustic oscillation. So for this, actually, dA goes to a constant for baryonic acoustic oscillation, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, so these are details. But I mean, you were right in that in your part. So,
sorry.
Yes?
So if the object we're looking at is moving on top of the expansion of the universe, mm-hmm. then are we going to get a wrong value for z, and then when we plug this in, we're going to find the wrong distance for the object and be all confused or something?
If it's moving.
If it's moving, yeah, on top.
Absolutely,
of
yes. That's exactly true. Now, we have reasons to believe, and actually good reasons, to believe that those are small. So those are so-called peculiar velocities. And let's write this down. So far, I assume you have a homogeneous universe. Everything is moving, is actually at rest in this coordinate system. That doesn't need to be true. Indeed, it's not. We have galaxies that are moving, stars, galaxies, planets. Everything is moving with respect to this. And that's called peculiar velocity, motion with respect to this co-moving frame. Now, it turns out that velocity is not very large. You have relativistic objects, but you have relativistic jets, but there are very few of them. So they are, most of the universe only moves with a small velocity, v over c, for most of the universe with respect to this background. is roughly of order 300 kilometers per second. Well, I mean, within a factor of 2 or so, depending on where you are. So it could be positive or negative. It could have a random direction. But it turns out for most of the universe, it's not less than this. It's not more than this. And you should compare this. V is 300 kilometers per second. So that means that V over C is this divided by 3 times 10 to the 5 kilometers per second, which is less than 10 to the minus 3, right? Or is 10 to the minus 3. So let's write this down. So that means that, now the thing is that that's how much perturbation or uncertainty you have is this order 10 to the minus 3. So you cannot, so the relationship between distance and redshift, this is exact if you have no peculiar velocity, but if you have some peculiar velocity, then you get error of 10 to the minus 3 in this relationship. Because that's how much your redshift essentially is changing. You add extra Doppler shift to your cosmological redshift. This is a random extra Doppler shift, but it still is a random. It is there. On average, it should go away, but it is a real uncertainty. So you're correct. Okay? So I guess I should also skim over the Hubble law. And the Hubble law you have already derived, so let's do it here. Okay, so I think I'm going to use those chalks there. Is that full? There are some colors, although might be a bit too late, too little, but anyway. You know, it's really an art how to use color charts too. I mean, that's what people used to use before they were PowerPoint, basically, so the color charts. So, of course, don't claim I have any expertise in it. Now, but I'm not sure how much of it. Now I'm not sure how much of it I got to tell you in the last few days. But Hubble law was, although it's not wasn't how historically things were exactly turned out. Hubble law was the first evidence for the cosmological principle that the universe must be homogeneous and isotropic. And you could go from one to the other if you. One is very easy to show that, and that's what you did on the first day. If the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, you must have a Hubble law, i.e., from Newtonian physics, velocity should go as h times distance. Let's call this d. Do not confuse with r. And the velocity At a small velocities, this is the same as this cosmological redshift. So these are all approximate. I'm setting c equal to 1 now. So redshift is roughly the velocity, it's roughly the Hubble constant times d. This is what you require for the universe to be homogeneous at every point in the universe. Now, this you derive from Newtonian physics. You can also derive this from this framework, and you can actually do it exactly to all distances, not only at the small distances. Of course, at large distances, this is not going to be an exact law anymore. there will be deviations from this relationship. What Hubble observed, and this is what it's called Hubble law, is that if you measure the redshift of objects, galaxies that is, and you measure their distance, and for distance you need some sort of a standard candle like Cepheus, that's what Hubble used. For redshift, if you have the spectrum of galaxies, and you think you understand, you think the atoms in other galaxies behave the same way, have the same atomic transitions as the atoms in our galaxy or on our laboratories, then you can measure the redshift. Basically, it's the ratio of excitation frequencies that you see in the spectra of other galaxies to the rest frame excitation frequency of the same atoms in our laboratories. From that, you can measure redshift by basically measuring the spectrum. And from some standard candle, for example, you can measure distance. And what Hubble noticed was that for most of the galaxies that you could see back then, they're roughly proportional to each other. So that was a discovery. And that can be proven from this framework. So what you want to do is just, so you could either take either of these two distances, and they are proportional to each other up to these redshift factors, and look at what you see on the light cone. Now, I think that everything that we see must be in our past light cone, right? So let's say this is time, and this is a space, x, y. You're seeing here, and everything that you can see right now, I think that were emitted sometime in the past and sit somewhere on our past light cone. Now, light cone is defined by the trajectory which photons take. If you assume that you're sitting at the center, and light is radially coming towards us, which, of course, if you're sitting at the center, only the radial trajectories of light gets to us. You assume d omega or d theta and d phi are zero. And if you have photons, they move on null geodesics, so ds is zero. And so let me assume k is zero for now. So let me assume k is zero for now. Then you get basically dr equals dt divided by a. So r equals integral of dt divided by a. Right? So this integral at short distances, if I want to reproduce the Hubble law, this is roughly delta t divided by a. Okay? And so let's see. I want to get the redshift out of this. So I can divide and multiply by h, let's say. And remember, h was a dot over a, so this is h. H delta t over a, h. Right. Okay. I think this, just use white color, I don't know why. So, h delta t is just delta log a, or it's delta a over a. Right. Because h is a dot over a, or time derivative of log a, so h delta t is just delta a over a. And then there is ah in the denominator. As long as this delta a is small, I can say this is delta a inverse divided by h. And remember, h inverse was redshift. So you had 1 plus d. If a naught was 1, this would be just 1 over a. So delta A inverse from now, where I'm sitting, redshift is 0. Remember, at r equal to 0, Well, okay, is it obvious here at R? At R equal to 0, redshift is 0, basically because A equals 1. So Z redshift is 0. Some finite distance, you have a finite redshift, so this is just redshift divided by H. So this is the derivation of the Hubble law at small distances. Now, at large distances, this is an actual integral that you have to take, if you, assuming that you know what A of t is. And that depends on the solution to this equation. So now you can show this as an exercise that, for example, if you define, let's define Q. Okay, so this is not a good color. Let's define this. If you define Q naught as minus a double dot divided by a dot squared today. So this is the so-called deceleration parameter. Then you can actually do a Taylor expansion, assuming that you know this is essentially the second derivative of a of t. H gives you the first derivative, Q naught gives you the second derivative, and you can derive something that looks like R is, let's see, 1 over H naught, redshift minus 1 half of 1 plus Q naught, redshift squared, plus higher order terms. So, okay. So you have Hubble law at the small redshift for z much less than 1. But this is really the first term in an expansion. And the higher order terms depend on higher derivatives of A, which in principle you can get from Friedmann equation. Now, if you can measure observationally this relationship, the first term just tells you what the Hubble constant is. But the second term actually tells you something about the Friedmann equation, actually tells us something about the content of our universe. And that is the subject of the next 10 minutes. I think a bit short, but maybe that's... I guess that's how much time we have. So does this make sense? So I'm just saying that if you have A of t, right, and I don't have it right now, but I can Taylor expand it, assuming that I have the first derivative, which is h, and the second derivative, which is given by this q. And I can at least, as an expansion, take this integral as in powers in redshift. And these are the first two terms. And it turns out that right now, actually, with people with supernovae 1a observations can measure even the second and third term in this expansion, because you can go to very high redshifts. And this is a development in the past 10 years or so. Before that, you could only do the first term. That only gave you H naught, which is it is an important constant, but it doesn't tell you much about the content of our universe. Okay. How big is H naught? Anybody remembers? 71. Good. What are the units?
I guess it's in units of acceleration over or not. Distance of.
What are the units of H naught, by the way?
Kilometers per second per megaparsec.
That's right. Good. So that tells you that if something is 10 megaparsec away from you, moving away at 710 kilometers per second, right? And the larger the distance, the larger the velocity. It actually has a dimension of 1 over time. So you could, if you know H naught and you know something else about the content of the universe, you can tell, you can just, based on measuring H naught, tell how old the universe is. So if you just take that number that you gave me, you get something around 10 billion actually you get 14 billion gigas, 14 billion years at the edge of the universe. Because this has a dimension of one of our time. Although the dimension that people usually quote it, it sounds kind of weird, but it's really dimension of one of our time. Because kilometers per second per megaparsec, kilometer and megaparsec have the same, are both length units. So this really just have one of our time unit. So let me see. So how long do you think I should go? It's always a tough question, right? Yeah. Well, when Rob kicks me out, let's see. But I think he's too polite. That's a problem. If you had somebody who would actually come in and kick me out, everything would work out that way. So now, we have this equation, and this is essentially all we need. OK, this and the continuity equation. So let me write that one as well. So this is one, and the other is continuity equation. And this is the other thing that you derived yesterday and the day before yesterday. Now, one thing that I'm going to add here, which may sound unfamiliar to you, is this W. But it's just a definition, a so-called equation of a state, which is defined as pressure divided by density. So here I had rho plus p, now I replace it by p, 1 plus w times rho. Now, what are the contents that we know exist in the universe? And I want to make a table here. So the kind of contents of the universe. So you could have radiation, anything relativistic. I call it radiation. You could have matter, say dark matter, baryons. Well, let's call this dust. So anything non-relativistic, basically, we call it dust in cosmology. Now, I have two weird kinds of matter. So these are the things that I'm kind of familiar based on relativistic physics. You'll know either you have relativistic particles or non-relativistic particles. Relativistic ones we call radiation, non-relativistic ones we call dust. But there are two other kinds, which you may not call them matter, but they are, cosmologists have a weird nomenclature. One is curvature, and the other is vacuum. Okay. So the first thing, without doing any cosmology, you could tell me what W is for each of them. So what is W for radiation? 5 halves. Is that right?
I don't think so. That's
good. Okay, any other guess? David said 1/3. Okay, so I'm going to take it. Now, this is something you must have seen somewhere. I can't quite say where, because I'm not sure how many of your courses, but pressure of radiation is 1/3 of its density.
I believe in statistical physics.
Have they seen it in a statistics? Have you seen it? Okay, you've seen it. Good. I assume that you've seen it. But it has actually very fun derivation. You can, just assuming that you have things that are moving with the speed of light, basically, you can show that the pressure must be 1/3 of the density, energy density. Thus, the W is essentially zero by definition. It's just to say that if you have particles whose rest mass is much bigger than their kinetic energy, the pressure is proportional to the kinetic energy of the particles. But if the rest mass is much bigger, that means that the pressure is much smaller than the energy density, right? Means kinetic energy is much less than the rest mass. Now, curvature is a weird thing. Okay, so let me write something here for you, and it should be obvious, actually. So I'm going to erase the deceleration parameter. You're not going to need it anymore. Density if you just solve this equation for fixed W, we can show that it's proportional to A to the power of minus 3 times 1 plus W. Now, can you see this? Okay, let's do this. 3 times 1 plus W is a very important power. So this means that the density for radiation goes down as 1 over A to the 4th, and for matter goes as 1 over A cubed. Now, these two are actually kind of obvious. Now, why this is the solution, I mean, if you can actually show this, it's very straightforward. You can just plug this in here and see that this is the solution. But it's the first order differential equation. You can just easily solve it. Now, why for radiation density goes down as 1 over A to the 4th is easy to understand this intuitively. You have a box that's expanding, so the number of photons, number density of photons goes down as 1 over volume of the box. But then they're also redshifted at the same time as 1 over A. So the energy density of photons goes up as 1 over A to the 4th. Now, for matter particles, if you have non-relativistic matter, the mass, the energy per particle is fixed. It's just the rest mass. But still, the number density of particles goes down as 1 over A cubed. So the energy density of dust goes down as 1 over A cubed. Now, curvature is not really matter. But this term here decays as 1 over A squared, which is different from these two. It's lower, actually. And if you want to give a W to it, it's not really have any pressure, but you can say that this is like some matter that has W of minus 1/3, and effective density goes down as 1 over A squared. Of course, it could be positive or negative depending on the sign of K. And vacuum. Minus 1. Why? Exactly. So if you want constant density, W should be minus 1. So it tells you rho is constant. And this, or you could call it cosmological constant. This is what people call it. And this is minus 1. So these are the four types of radiation that we have. And so content of the universe. And I leave this for you. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow. I doubt it. But you can actually solve the Friedmann equation assuming that either of these terms dominate. So if you assume that matter dominates, so you can ignore curvature assuming that one of those other terms dominates. So all you have is this term and then matter with that kind of scaling on the right-hand side. So in these cases, for radiation, you get A goes as T to the 1/2. For dust goes as T to the 2/3. For curvature, this goes as T. You should remember this because this was an empty universe. And for vacuum, this goes actually exponentially, E to the HT, or H naught T. So this is how universe looks like. And it turns out that, you see, the thing that decays the faster means it's the biggest at early times. So this is actually the chronological order of the things that dominate our universe. At very early times, you have radiation. Then you have dust. Then in principle, you have curvature, although it turns out that constant happens to be very small. So this one is kind of missing for some reason, and that's a puzzle. That's the so-called flatness problem. And then there's vacuum, which we happen. So for some reason, this one is missing from the history of the universe. But yeah, so as you see, this is exactly the order you expect these to dominate. The one that is biggest at the very early times, that very universe was very small, is radiation. That's what dominates. At very late times, the thing that's constant. So when these things all decay, this guy remains. This dominates the expansion of the universe. So I think this is a good time to stop. But one thing I want to do is to derive a conformal time. If you remember, it was just integral of dt over a in these phases. That's what Hirani needs me to do. But that's easy enough, so I can do it tomorrow. Okay, thank you. Yes?
So that second term,
this term, yeah. It's related to the content of the universe. It's So it turns out that if you have no vacuum energy, then you can measure curvature, okay, from this. But if you have vacuum energy, there is a combination of the. It's rho. Well, I mean, you could put this in here if you're interested. Yeah. So it tells you something about how this whole thing escapes, basically. Because essentially, Q was the second derivative of A, and I can actually calculate Q in each of these phases. That's right. So, yeah. So you can measure it and see exactly in which phase you are. It turns out that you are somewhere in between these two phases, between dust and vacuum. There doesn't seem to be any curvature. Exactly. That's how it's done. Yeah. Kind of problem.